Illustrated. My name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Let's begin with a feature from this month's Sports Illustrated entitled Juan Soto Free Agency, Full Timeline, Reported Team Meetings, and More. Soto is expected to get an historically large contract. And this feature is written by Sports Illustrated writer Josh Wilson. Last Major League Baseball offseason, all eyes were on Shohei Ohtani. This offseason, it's Juan Soto. Every winter, several interesting free agents become available for teams to court and attempt to add to their roster in a quest to improve their odds of the ultimate goal, winning a World Series. While some free agents fit more in the category of situational additions, like teams looking for more hitting from a particular side or help at a specific defensive position, there are players who are showstoppers. You add them if you have the chance to, no matter how they fit your roster now, and figure the rest out later. Soto is one of those players. And much like Ohtani, his free agency will be a massive domino in regards to free agency at large. Teams interested in spending on Soto will have lots of money to spend in their budget, but only once they learn they're definitely out of the running on Soto. So the question now becomes, how much will he earn on the new deal? Short answer, likely anywhere between $430 million and $700 million. Several factors play into how much a player can earn on his contract in a salary capless world. How good is the player? How old are they? What length of deal are they looking for? And how is the contract structured? Soto sits in the top tier of players that can essentially ask for the quote-unquote new record, a deal that bests the previous high water mark. John Heyman reported on October 31st that Soto was seeking a $700 million deal. That raw value would be the same as the one that Ohtani landed on last winter with the Los Angeles Dodgers. However, Ohtani's deal is unique and largely deferred. The present value of Ohtani's contract when signed last offseason was around $337 million. Taking into other factors, it has been described as a value closer to $430 million. Heyman later reported Soto's deal, quote-unquote, could reach $600 million, but did not write off a $700 million contract. It sounds as if Soto is not interested in a largely deferred deal. Surely some team may offer him the $700 million that he and his agent, Scott Boras, seek, but that may not be Soto's final decision. players routinely take pay cuts for situations they view as more favorable, and all indications are that Soto heavily values a setting that will give him lots of chances at the playoffs. Heyman reported on November the 17th that it's not known if any teams that met with Soto over the last week have made any offers. Other reporting indicated that the Red Sox did not make an offer during their November the 14th meeting with the Star. Scott Boras, Soto's agent, said in early November that the decision will not be soon. He cited an abnormally large number of interested parties that Soto and Boras want to vet fully. Many have speculated the winter meetings to be the most likely time for a deal to get done. Those take place December 8th through the 12th. Here is a look at how every team reported to have met with Soto to this point. Soto met with the Boston Red Sox on November the 14th, the first team reported to have met with him. Soto was said to be impressed with the presentation that Boston Brass put on. Soto then met with the Toronto Blue Jays on November the 15th, another meeting described as quote-unquote impressive. The most recent team to meet with Soto was the New York Mets on November the 16th. He met with them on Saturday, and the Queens contingency was described as quote-unquote hopeful coming out of the meeting. The New York Yankees are thought to be up next in Soto meetings, according to Heyman. No one has received a follow-up meeting yet. And again, that feature entitled Juan Soto Free Agency, full timeline, reported team meetings, and more. Soto is expected to get an historically large contract. Written by Sports Illustrated writer Josh Wilson. And from baseball news in Sports Illustrated's website, now let's turn to some golf news. Headline reads, paying U.S. Ryder Cup players was never going to be popular. Given the staggering amount of money flowing through pro golf and a 2025 Ryder Cup that's already being called greedy, Bob Herrig writes that fallout from a proposal to pay players was inevitable. And this feature written by Bob Herrig of Sports Illustrated. This was never going to go well. No chance. Zero. Especially not in this climate. Not with the men's professional game caught up in an unending, exhausting dialogue that seems to be an unsustainable situation given there is more and more money offered to players with a questionable return. The report from The Telegraph last week said that the PGA of America was considering payouts of $400,000 per U.S. Ryder Cup player at next year's competition to be played at Bethpage Black has been received as expected. It has led to charges about players being greedy, with the Americans especially looking bad because such payments would not go to their European counterparts. Never mind that there is an argument to be made for such payments. The Ryder Cup brings in millions. It is a huge cash cow for both the PGA of America and the DP World Tour. And everyone associated with the event gets paid except for the players. So, sure, that reality exists. It simply was never going to come off properly, especially not now. I personally would pay for the privilege to play in the Ryder Cup, Rory McIlroy said last week in Dubai, ahead of his victory at the DP World Tour Championship. Quote, I have come a long way in this, especially with the Olympics, but the two purest forms of competition in our game right now are the Ryder Cup and Olympics, partly because of the purity of no money being involved. It was a discussion that was happening in the last Ryder Cup in Rome. I can see the other side of the argument because the Ryder Cup does create a lot of revenue. It's one of the top five biggest sporting events in the world, so I get the argument that the talent could be getting paid. The Ryder Cup is so much more than that, especially to the Europeans and this tour. We've all had a conversation about it with European captain Luke Donald because we obviously heard about the possible U.S. plans, and the common consensus is that the $5 million paid to the team would be better spent on the DP World Tour to support other events and even to support the Challenge Tour. For us, it would give a very different feel. What we have done is a very good job is being a very cohesive group over the last decade, and we wouldn't want anything to change that, unquote. The unpopular view is that the players deserve to be paid, especially when you consider the enormous amount of money that the event generates, made especially more clear when it was learned that spectators would be paying $750 a day for regular admission in 2025, a number that would bring in more than $22 million per day. That does not include corporate hospitality, alcohol sales, parking, merchandise, and the tickets sold for the practice rounds. That is on top of the $440 million that the organization is receiving over 15 years from NBC. McIlroy's comments point out a difference in the setup. The DP World Tour is the main beneficiary of the proceeds from a Ryder Cup, which helps the tour operate over a four-year period. On the American side, the PGA Tour only reaps 20% of the television revenue, or roughly $88 million. That works out to be about $6 million per year, or $12 million over two Ryder Cups. Xander Schauffele's father, Stefan, was quoted often last year in Rome, and it led to some of the conjecture that the U.S. players were subtly protesting a lack of compensation. The elder Schauffele seemed to suggest more transparency is in order, and that the money that goes to the PGA Tour does not directly come back to the players. Quote, "They are using players' intellectual properties to make money, and the American players don't get paid," Stefan Schauffele told the Times of London last year. More importantly, this would become a non-issue if all proceeds, net proceeds from the Ryder Cup, were to be donated to common charitable causes. Right now, the American players are asked to donate their time pro bono in the name of patriotism, so these organizations can benefit from the profits. The PGA of America uses this money, and the PGA Tour gets 20% that goes into the retirement of every member. The 12 players supposedly need to eat it, and their intellectual property gets abused for the benefit of 200 other people. That's not right, unquote. The PGA of America has been earmarking $200,000 per player to donate to a charity of their choice. Doubling that is still a tiny sum in relation to the entire windfall, but perhaps a better, more public plan of distribution would help. I don't think any of the 24 players on either team needs the $400,000, McIlroy said. Every 2 years we play, there's 104 weeks. And for 103, you can play golf and can get paid, so that's reasonable enough. Going back to the purity aspect, it would make the competition seem a little less pure, but it wouldn't change anything from a European perspective. We would all welcome the money if it didn't change the dynamic of what we had, but I think that it would change the dynamic, unquote. McIlroy makes fair points. So, too, is the notion that they keep score at the Ryder Cup, that the result matters, that it is hardly the exhibition that he, as a young man, suggested in 2010 before competing in his first Ryder Cup. Careers are enhanced or derided based on Ryder Cups, and nobody in sport plays for free. So there are some very conflicting narratives here. Still, given where the game is right now, with the PGA Tour seeking billions in private equity to further enrich its star players, while LIV Golf has offered huge signing bonuses and big purses every week, the rare event where money is not the issue is welcome. The PGA of America is said to be considering the proposal, with a board vote to decide after a new CEO is hired. The negative fallout will surely continue. If this was simply a trial balloon on the PGA of America's part, might be best to pop it right now and figure out some other way to handle the situation. Another Race to Dubai title leaves Rory McIlroy tied with one of Europe's all-time best players in Seve Ballesteros and within two of the all-time leader Colin Montgomery. McIlroy wrapped up his Race to Dubai title before winning the tournament as well, capping a four-victory season that will likely be most remembered for his close call at the U.S. Open. McIlroy seemed poised to win his fifth major title at Pinehurst in June when he built a two-shot lead on the back nine, only to bogey three of the last four holes and watch in despair as Bryson DeChambeau miraculously got up and down from a bunker to make par and win by a shot. McIlroy excited Pinehurst that afternoon hastily and in obvious pain, and that loss was hard to shake. He failed to win again until Sunday after more painful close calls at the Irish Open and the BMW Championship along the way. It makes for a bittersweet year that probably would be lauded to a much higher degree if it were anyone else. Quote, "Unfortunately for Rory, I think everybody looks at the glass half empty," said Shane Lowry, who teamed with McIlroy to win the Zurich Classic of New Orleans back in April. "I look at it as glass half full. He's had an amazingly consistent year. I've had a consistent year, but he's had consistent top three finishes. Mine are top 15s. After Sunday, it will be four wins around the world. Obviously, he gives himself chances, and he probably should have won the U.S. Open, let's be honest. And he would say that himself, but he didn't. I think he is more determined than ever to come out firing next year, and obviously the Masters will be on the forefront as my mind and same as myself. He'll be looking towards the other big tournaments and the Ryder Cup. The career he's had so far is incredible. He has not dropped outside of the top 50 in the world rankings in the last 15 years or something. It's an absolute joke. He's putting himself up there with the greats of European golf, not that he already wasn't, and I'm sure he's got Monty's records in his sights as well, unquote. In addition to the four worldwide victories, which included bookend wins in Dubai, McIlroy had nine other top five finishes across a total of 27 events, including the Olympics. In all, he had 15 top 15 finishes and missed a single cut at the British Open. As Lowry pointed out, McIlroy will undoubtedly get plenty of attention heading to the Masters, the major that he needs to complete a career Grand Slam. It's been a frustrating journey made more difficult by the fact that he has gone 10 years without any major victories. But at age 35, McIlroy is some 17 years into a career that is seemingly just as good as ever. He is ranked third in the official world golf ranking. Aside from the one-day exhibition next month with Scottie Scheffler, Brooks Koepka, and DeChambeau, he is unlikely to play again until late January at the Dubai event, where he will be defending. McIlroy has vowed to cut back on the 27-event schedule that he played this year, and it will be interesting to see where he goes in 2025. The regular season ended nearly 3 months ago, but the PGA Tour has soldiered on with its FedEx Fall that comes to a conclusion this week with the RSM Classic. Like Rafael Campos, who stunningly won the Bermuda Championship on Sunday, several of the fall winners have come out of nowhere to grab two-year exemptions along with Masters spots and several other perks in 2025. For those outside of the top 125 or just around it, this is an especially big week. It means an opportunity for full exempt status in 2025, but also with the knowledge that things could get even more competitive next year. On Monday, the PGA Tour Policy Board was expected to vote on a proposal that would see the all-exempt tour go from 125 to 100 spots in 2026, with the Korn Ferry exemptions shrinking from 30 to 20. In addition, field sizes during the regular season would be cut, with many going to 120 players. That means less spots to compete, but a far more competitive landscape. Just getting a crack at it next year will be important. Currently, Wesley Bryant is in the 125th position after moving up three spots following the Bermuda Championship. Joel Dahman is 124th. Four-time tour winner Daniel Berger is one of the players who fell out of the top 125 in Bermuda. This is also an opportunity for players outside of the top 50 in FedEx points to move into the top 60 or retain their position there. The players who finish 51st to 60th will get spots in the first two signature events in 2025, Pebble Beach and the Genesis. Among those who earned Masters invites this fall, among other things with victories, were Patton Kazeri, Kevin Yu, Matt McCarty, Nico Enchevarria, Austin Ekerot, and Campos. The Masters field is now up to 76 players, with a few more who are going to get in via the year-end top 50 in the official world golf ranking. Winners in 2025, as well as another top 50 deadline prior to the tournament, will likely bring the field up to the low 90s. And again, that Sports Illustrated feature is entitled Paying U.S. Ryder Cup Players Was Never Going to Be Popular, written by Bob Herrig, a Sports Illustrated writer. And moving on now to the scorecard section of the November edition of Sports Illustrated, this essay is entitled Believe the Hype. Caitlin Clark entered the WNBA under massive expectations. Somehow, she exceeded them. And this feature written by Emma Bachelieri of Sports Illustrated. Start with a full court pass. Start with something almost no one else could see. Start with her feet just past the logo, finding her way out of a trap, sinking a signature bucket. Start with her scrambling past a defender, catching and shooting from the corner, her body falling away in a shot that is miraculously good enough to make up for all of the mechanical rules that it breaks. Or realize that it does not particularly matter where you start. Therein lies the beauty of Caitlin Clark. All roads lead to potential highlights. Each of the above examples, plus a few more, came from one late-season game when Clark's Fever beat Atlanta in overtime 104-100. A few weeks later, Clark wrapped up a rookie campaign not quite like any that have come before. After a singular college career, she entered the league under the weight of tremendous expectations, frequently positioned not so much as a basketball player but as a cultural phenomenon unto herself. That dynamic came with intense scrutiny and coverage to match, including plenty from people and places who had rarely shown previous interest in women's basketball, or women, or basketball for that matter. The cumulative effect could have been staggering, yet she ultimately did something that previously seemed all but impossible given the context. Clark played to match the hype. The national discourse around the 22-year-old sometimes drifted so far afield of basketball that it could feel totally divorced from what she was actually doing on the court. First, there was discussion of her primarily as marketing engine or economic force, both of which she has been. WNBA attendance, viewership, and merchandise sales have spiked, with a consistent focal point being Clark. Indiana saw explosive growth in everything from tickets and jerseys to mascot bookings and beer sales. And then there was the discussion of her as a symbol in a dizzying array of culture wars, often only indirectly related to her, if at all. What she herself actually said or did seemed to matter little here. Fires raged around projections and loose abstractions. At least one book is being written about the impact of her summer. It's hardly surprising that when Clark played her final contest of the regular season on the road in Washington, D.C. on September 19th, lawmakers from both parties announced plans to use the game with the Mystics as a fundraiser. Not as if there was a need for anything extra to produce an attendance boost. Clark and the Fever drew 20,711 fans that night, the largest crowd in the history of the WNBA, filled with little girls and grown men alike sporting her jersey. But underneath all of that conversation, of course, Clark was hooping. And on the other side of some early growing pains, especially during a brutal opening stretch for Indiana, she became simply too good to ignore. Put aside everything off the court for a moment. Clark started to grow into the player that was promised, and then some. The core of that is still what made her so effective in college at Iowa. It's her shooting range, yes, but it's more so her vision and her ability to facilitate. By the end of the season, she was no longer as vexed by pro defenses as she was in her first weeks in the league. The same traps and blitzes that stymied her in the early going no longer proved quite so effective. Clark returned after the league's break for the Paris Olympics, her first extended period of time off since the summer of 2023, notably stronger and smarter on the floor. The result was an historically potent offensive campaign. No one had ever scored this much while assisting this much. No player in WNBA history had ever averaged 15 points and 8 assists per game for a season. Yet Clark cleared that comfortably at 19.2 points per game and 8.4 assists per game, breaking not just rookie records, but league ones as well. It helped the Fever break a WNBA record 7-year playoff drought. That, of course, required more from Indiana than just Clark. A Fever squad that had looked stiff and disjointed found its identity down the stretch. The team picked up the pace and ditched much of its reliance on forced set plays. Aliyah Boston, the 2023 Rookie of the Year, grew more assertive in the paint and found her chemistry with Clark. Coach Christy Sides found rotations that worked, more of Lexi Hull, who established herself on the wing and showed a greater willingness to make adjustments. And a key part of that growth for the group across the board was Clark at point guard, setting up everyone to play their best. The backcourt pairing of Clark and Kelsey Mitchell looked among the best in the WNBA. Having a high-value point guard obviously opens things up in a positive way, says Mitchell. I always thought that we could play up-tempo at a fast pace, and now you guys get to see it, unquote. Mitchell has spent her entire career, that is, 7 seasons, in Indiana. The attention this year has been like nothing she could have previously imagined. Quote, shout out to Caitlin, she says. She's done an unbelievable job of bringing her fans and people that support her, unquote. That put the Fever in the playoffs, an especially striking development considering how the group looked during a 3-win, 10-loss start of the season. Quote, I feel like any team that goes through adversity grows together, and definitely with our schedule at the start, we were forced to kind of build that quickly, Hull said in June. Hopefully, by the end of the season, we'll be able to look at that start and be like, that helped prepare us for the end. You're forced to kind of block out the noise. Everyone has an opinion, and so it's trying just to not let that creep in and stay strong together and have our circle be really tight, unquote. The noise only increased, but so did the level of performance at its center. The question of whether Clark's rookie season is the best ever is tricky. Candace Parker was league MVP in her first year. There have been rookies who scored more, and certainly those who were far stronger defenders, but Clark established a rookie season that felt singular in its gravitational pull. Clark made the adjustment. It's now up to everyone else to adjust to Clark. And again, that essay is entitled Believe the Hype. Caitlin Clark entered the WNBA under massive expectations. Somehow she exceeded them. Written by Sports Illustrated writer Emma Bachelieri. And in another feature from this month's Sports Illustrated scorecard section, headline reads, Ohtani's Odyssey. The double threat has had an amazing run, and it's only going to get better. And this feature written by Tom Verducci of Sports Illustrated. What if the unprecedented, unfathomable, unimaginable achievement of 50-50 is just the beginning? What if this colossal wonder that Shohei Ohtani has put before us is only the appetizer? What if this is only the first line of book one of a baseball epic? Tell me, O muse of the man of many ways. True it may be, we should not be surprised that Ohtani is headed for bigger and better, such as next year when he returns to the mound and resumes contending for the Cy Young Award and the home run title. Please read that sentence again. Slowly. Never get used to the enormity of that duality. Those who know Ohtani will tell you that 50-50 is not accumulation, but a beginning. Hideki Koriyama knows Ohtani better than most. He's the man who made possible the unique greatness of Ohtani. As Ohtani was graduating from high school, he seemed so likely to sign with a major league organization that some thought that a Nippon Pro Baseball team would be wasting a top draft pick on him. Koriyama was the manager of the Nippon Ham Fighters. He knew a major league organization was likely to develop Ohtani as either a pitcher or a hitter. Koriyama challenged him to take a path where no one tread, sign with the Fighters to pitch and hit, to be a master of Nitoryu, the two-sword fighting style. Once he had established himself as a two-way player, Koriyama told the player that he could jump to Major League Baseball with both disciplines as a condition of his signing. Ohtani signed on to the dream. Koriyama managed him for 5 years before Ohtani signed with the Los Angeles Angels. Koriyama was also Ohtani's manager during the 2022 World Baseball Classic. Koriyama believes that Ohtani is only just getting started. Quote, the numbers are incredible, but the ceiling I see for him is much higher, Koriyama told the Japan Times. He makes a lot of mistakes at the plate. Honestly, I think he has the ability to hit around 80 home runs, unquote. 80? Whoa. But then, Ohtani is incomparable. His horizons extend beyond all others. And when you think about his path to 50-50, why wouldn't this only be the start of more unique greatness? Here are some of the key parts of his journey and some that might lie ahead. First, increased strength. Ohtani has the long, limber levels of a Michael Phelps. Indeed, he was a competitive swimmer from kindergarten through fifth grade. He is hyper-flexible at the elbow and the shoulder joints. Signed by the Angels at around 210 pounds, Ohtani has added more than 20 pounds without losing athleticism or flexibility. It's the one comment I get the most, his agent Nez Baledo says. If I heard it once, I heard it 1,000 times. He's much bigger in person. He's a beast, unquote. In 2021, Ohtani set a personal record in average exit velocity at 93.6 miles per hour, broke it in 2023 at 94.4 miles per hour, and broke it again this year at 95.6 miles per hour. There is a pattern here. And how is this for an outlier of Ruthian proportions? Ohtani leads the majors with 9 home runs of at least 450 feet. That's more than every team except the Rockies, who benefit from added distance from playing home games a mile high. Another key part of Ohtani's journey, the Dodgers and the Dodgers' resources on offense. This is no knock on the Angels, but no team has greater depth of staff, technology, analytics, and systems than the Dodgers. As one veteran pitcher put it just days after having joined the franchise, quote, "Now I feel like I'm in the major leagues," unquote. This year, Ohtani's base running has benefited from the wisdom of veteran base coaches Dino Ebel and Clayton McCullough and the video scouting of the analytics department. With a week to go in the regular season, Ohtani had the second highest stolen base percentage among players with 50 stolen bases, trailing only Max Carey's 96.2% from 102 years ago. Ohtani was 55 for 59, including 32 stolen bases in a row. "He's clearly done a lot of research," Kuriyama said. "I think that he watches the pitchers closely, noticing even the slightest shift in weight that indicates a throw to home. This year, even though he hasn't been able to pitch, it seems like he is enjoying that aspect of the game," unquote. Then there's the Dodgers' resources on the mound. Among active pitchers who have started 86 games, Ohtani ranks second in strikeout rate at 11.2, just behind teammate Tyler Glasnow, and third in winning percentage at 667, even more remarkable because he has never pitched for a winning team, and third in ERA with a ERA of 3.01. With his foundation of pitches, Dodger know-how, the team's defensive efficiency, which is routinely among baseball's best, and the way that the club emphasizes recovery, it's not a stretch to say that Ohtani may be even more dominant on the mound next year. Finally, there's the issue of closing holes in his game. Ohtani had so much raw power on elevated pitches and so much less on pitches low in the strike zone that for the first half of the season, Los Angeles Dodgers manager Dave Roberts encouraged him not to swing at low strikes. Through his first 72 games, Ohtani hit only one home run on any pitch in the bottom rail of the strike zone. But then Ohtani, who hits from an upright posture with his hands high, which can make covering low pitches difficult, simply closed that hole in his game. In his next 83 games, Ohtani hit 9 homers in the bottom rail. As a child, Ohtani so loved baseball that people called him a Yukyu Shonen, that is, a boy who holds the game deep in his heart. The uniqueness of 50-50 prompted not just awe at the feat, but an appreciation of the person who did it. Casual fans checked in to see what the fuss was about and came away seeing the Yukyu Shonen in him. The way Ohtani exulted and threw his cap after striking out then-teammate Mike Trout to end the 2023 World Baseball Classic, the way that he pumped his fist upon the 50th home run, the way he shouted, "Let's go," while rounding the bases upon his game-tying homer, his 53rd long ball of the year in late September, these were expressions of pure joy in meaningful moments that we had never seen before from him. There is an organic quality to his greatness. He is setting records without chasing them. I am not in awe. It's like I'm numb, Agent Bolelo says. On the night that Ohtani reached 50-50 with a mad burst of 6 hits, including 3 home runs and 10 RBIs, after going 2-for-10 with 5 strikeouts the previous 2 nights in Miami, Bolelo had one question for him. Where, he asked Ohtani, did that come from? I have no idea, Ohtani replied. Homer wrote in the Odyssey, quote, there is no greater fame for a man than that which he wins with his footwork or the skill of his hands, unquote. Ohtani is the rarity who has achieved his fame by way of both means. The epic has begun. Tell us more, O Muse, about this man of many ways. And again, that feature is entitled Ohtani's Odyssey. The double threat has had an amazing run, and it's only going to get better. Written by Sports Illustrated writer Tom Verducci. And in college basketball news from Sports Illustrated's website, this headline reads, Juju Watkins reaches college basketball scoring milestone faster than Caitlin Clark. The USC star is already chasing history in her second collegiate season. And this feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Tim Capurso. USC sophomore Juju Watkins reached a career milestone faster than Indiana Fever star and Division I all-time leading scorer Caitlin Clark in the Trojans' 81-50 win over the Santa Clara Broncos on Friday at Galen Center. With 6:47 remaining in the third quarter, Watkins drained a jumper from the free throw line to extend the Trojans' lead to 18 points and give the sophomore guard 1,000 points in her college career. Watkins reached the mark in her 38th game, tied for the fourth fewest games in NCAA Division I history. Caitlin Clark, who went on to become the all-time leading scorer in Division I women's basketball and later the all-time leading scorer in Division I basketball, male or female, reached that milestone in 40 games. Watkins also achieved the feat quicker than any player in Trojans women's basketball history. I'm not taking anything for granted, Watkins said after the game. I'm very blessed to be in this position. This is great, something to build off of and continue to work on, unquote. Watkins' coach, Lindsey Gottlieb, perhaps summed up best the company that Watkins is joining with such an accomplishment. Quote, when you break a record at USC, it hits a little different because the people you break the record from are so great, Gottlieb said. Juju belongs in that conversation, and we are all comfortable in saying it. It was the great Cheryl Miller who was next, unquote. Watkins cemented herself as an elite scorer when she dropped 51 points in a February 2024 game to help the Trojans upset then number 4 ranked Stanford. Among the fastest to reach 1,000 career points, could Watkins next take aim at Clark's Division I record 3,951 points? And again, that feature is entitled Juju Watkins reaches college basketball scoring milestone faster than Caitlin Clark, written by Sports Illustrated writer Tim Capurso. And from women's basketball news, let's turn to some men's college basketball news. This next headline reads, Purdue men's basketball scores identity test win in knocking off Alabama. Plus, other contenders have emerged after the first 2 weeks of the season as Indiana and Illinois make their cases and a host of dark horses lurk. This feature written by Sports Illustrated writer Kevin Sweeney. Big November college basketball games are often best used as measuring sticks, and perhaps no men's team in the country had more to prove over the weekend than the Purdue Boilermakers. Matt Painter's club was the preseason favorite in the Big Ten almost by default, but there was plenty of skepticism about the Boilers' ability to compete for a return trip to the Final Four with Zach Edey no longer wearing gold and black. Early game results had done Purdue no favors, struggling to put away Texas A&M Corpus Christi Islanders and getting bludgeoned in the paint by the Yale Bulldogs were early potential warning signs. Playing the Alabama Crimson Tide, the number two team in the Associated Press poll with over half of its 10-man rotation on the NBA radar in some form, figured to answer the early question of whether Purdue could hang with a top team in the sport. And that answer, a resounding yes. Purdue's post-Edey identity is still developing, but last Friday's win over the highly ranked Tide was a huge step. Even without their two-time National Player of the Year dominating the paint, Purdue put up a hyper-efficient offensive day, dicing up Alabama's defense to the tune of nearly 1.3 points per possession. The path to victory in high-level games like last Friday's is narrower for the Boilermakers than it was a year ago, but they showed off the formula against the Crimson Tide. Trey Kaufman Wren has taken the leap that Purdue hoped for this offseason, emerging as the front court's top offensive weapon after sitting in Edey's shadows the last two seasons. While nowhere near as physically imposing at 6'9", 230 pounds, Kaufman Wren's quickness and mobility creates different problems for opposing defenses, and he is also a better passer than Edey was on the block. He turned in the finest game of his college career Friday night, going for 26 points, 8 rebounds, and 4 assists in the winning effort. Alabama refused to send double teams to the post, and Purdue was happy to feed Kaufman Wren almost every trip. Then there's the elite guard play for Purdue. There are as many good point guards across college basketball as there have been in a long time, but you'd be hard-pressed to find one better than Braden Smith. Smith outplayed Alabama star Mark Sears last Friday, even on a day that he didn't shoot it great, tallying 10 assists to just one turnover and scoring 17 points. Through four games, he's averaging over 15 points, 6 rebounds, and 9 assists per game. Friday's performance was early validation that the Boilermakers will remain a fixture at the top of what is shaping up to be a wildly entertaining Big Ten race. And here's a look at some of the other contenders and how they have fared through the first 2 weeks, starting with the Indiana Hoosiers. I stayed in state following the Friday Alabama-Purdue showdown to get a first look at Indiana in the Hoosiers' first high major game of the season against the South Carolina Gamecocks. And while the Hoosiers are not a finished product yet, it's clear that Mike Woodson's team has made major strides after last season's debacle. Much of the preseason attention went to the addition of Arizona transfer Umar Ballo at center. But the biggest needle mover in my eyes has been Washington State transfer point guard Miles Rice. Rice was fantastic on Saturday, flashing his elite shot-making prowess off the bounce and looking like the team's emotional leader, hyping up the crowd after big shots that helped Indiana take an early lead that it never relinquished. But limiting the contenders list in the Big Ten to just two or three of the league's 18 teams would be foolish. So far, there hasn't been much to separate a lot of these teams. The big surprise thus far has been Wisconsin, with the Badgers off to a 5-win, no-loss start, highlighted by a 15-point win Friday night over Arizona. The Badgers have been buoyed by the play of Missouri transfer John Tonjay, who had 41 points in the Arizona win and looks capable of shouldering much of the scoring load that A.J. Storr took on a year ago. And Ohio State looked sharp against Texas in the season opener and has gotten big contributions early on from freshman John Mobley Jr., with Mobley, Bruce Thornton, and Michi Johnson Jr. The Buckeyes look to have one of the better backcourts in the league. And again, that feature is entitled Purdue Men's Basketball Scores Identity Test Win in Knocking Off Alabama. Plus, other Big Ten contenders have emerged after the first 2 weeks of the season, and a host of dark horses lurk, written by Sports Illustrated writer Kevin Sweeney. And that's all the time that we have for this reading of Sports Illustrated. Again, my name is Bill, volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for tuning in to this week's reading of Sports Illustrated. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcast info. And you could hear Sun Sounds on your smart home device.